listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods, hosted by yours truly, the skeptical Ghost Heathen. Let's see, Twizzlers or Red Vines? Either way, you're going to need some to take with you on this journey. Hello, heathens, and welcome back to the show. Today is December 14th, and oh my god, Kris Kringlemas Day is almost here. And I'm going to try to wrap up this episode before the end of the year so we can move into a brand new season come January 1st. All new year, all new season, all new topic. But in this particular episode, we're going to handle the last two arguments that Christian apologists like to use for evidence that Paul referred to a historical Jesus. And one is going to be the reference to brothers of the Lord, his brother, right? Jesus having a brother, James. And we're also going to talk about those 500 eyewitnesses to a risen Jesus. So guys, strap on your seatbelts and let's get ready to blast off into 2023. Let's do it. There are a couple more excuses that the desperate try to cling to. The only actual evidence they have is that twice Paul mentions brothers of the Lord. Once as a generic group, as seen in 1 Corinthians 9:5, and one naming a specific person belonging to it, James, in Galatians 1:19. The first of these appear where Paul seems to be arguing as follows. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, at least I am to you. For you are my seal of apostleship in the Lord. My defense to those who are putting me on trial is this. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along with us a sister as a wife? As also the other apostles and brothers of the Lord and Cephas do? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to give up working for our keep? 1 Corinthians 9, verses 1 through 6. Now it's notable to point out that this passage is completely out of place, because the argument that Paul is responding to is seemingly lost. Whatever charge he was defending himself against here in 9:3. And it would have been explained, actually, in the preceding verses. But in fact, in the present letters, those verses are on a different and largely unrelated controversy, as seen in 1 Corinthians 8, verses 1 all the way through 13. And then, oddly enough, the subject just abruptly and inexplicably changes. Like other epistles, 1 Corinthians seems to be like this mismatch of several other letters, several other arguments being smashed together. And here the preceding part of whatever letter this came from was left out, which is a curious fact in itself. But nevertheless, in the text as they were edited and spliced together, from what Paul goes on to say, we could tell that he was basically being accused of being a moocher, or threatening to be a moocher anyway, not earning his keep, and just like laying around, drinking beer, hitting the pipe, seeing dreams of Jesus, and eating the Corinthians, evidently out of house and home. And at some point, they must have put their foot down. And Barnabas, too, apparently, and evidently a wife in their company. Most likely the wife of Barnabas, I guess, as Paul elsewhere implies that he'd never married. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 7 through 8. But Paul seems to think that every traveling minister was allowed to take his wife with him, to be fed by the community along with him. At least if she was a believer, right? Or a sister of the Lord. And Paul's defense is that every other traveling minister was allowed to do this. That is, to do, no work, but minister the congregations. And in return, be fed by the congregation's expense. And he goes on to cite scripture and commandments from Jesus, received by revelation or hallucination while hitting on that pipe. Another argument's in defense of the principle. But his first argument is to cite the fact that he and Barnabas are being singled out unfairly. That, since everyone else got to do it, so should they. Now, it's important to note this context, because Paul's not talking about the right to be married or to have wives. He's only talking about the right to bring one with him when he travels for work, traveling on church business, and expects the community to feed her, and not expect her or him to work in return beyond whatever church business that they're traveling for. He's therefore only talking about Christians who are traveling on church business, which would have included not just apostles, those who have received revelations of the Lord, which was the primary qualification that he opens with, and therefore who were sent by the Lord himself to minister, but Christians of other ranks and duties as well, those who were sent by human authorities to deliver church letters or conduct inter-church business. Now, accordingly, when Paul says, in quotation, "the other apostles and brothers of the Lord and Cephas get to take wives with them on church business without having to work for their keep," he is not singling out the family of Jesus here as some sort of specially privileged group, never elsewhere mentioned by Paul, not even when he lists the ranks of people and the jobs out in the church. Starting, with scribes, apostles, editors, whatever. It doesn't make the cut. All 1 Corinthians 12:28. And this is where you would think that he would have mentioned it if the family of Jesus was being given some sort of special privileges or even authority. Instead, Paul is talking about all other Christians who were, in fact, all brothers of the Lord. And this is evident from the fact that Paul is completely unaware of any need here to distinguish a biological person, a biological family member, from an adoptive family member, biological brother from adoptive brother, because all baptized Christians were, in fact, the brothers of the Lord. And all Christian women were sisters of the Lord. And all Christians knew this. So Paul would need to be a little bit more specific if he was going to use this phrase of an actual biological brother. So, brother of the Lord? I don't think so. But such a distinction would probably have become even standard practice, such as by saying, brothers of the Lord by birth, or brothers of Jesus, or biological brother, whatever. Additionally, since other Christians besides apostles must have been in the position Paul has in mind, such as traveling on church business and therefore in need of being fed, I think we should expect him to have included them in his example. However, for whatever reason, they are conspicuously absent here. I think it's also important to note that Paul does not say here, or anywhere else for that matter, brothers of Jesus, but only brothers of the Lord, which has to be like this cultic title and not something that would be more personal that would be used for family members. One does not become the brother of the Lord until the person in question is hailed the Lord, hence the phrase brother of the Lord. It's a creation of Christian ideology. Now, yes, one might have earned that cultic title by actually being the brother of Jesus. But as the sample evidence shows, one would also have earned it by simply being baptized as a Christian. Now, certainly, Paul seems quite certain that one could not have any special privilege from being biological relations. Because apart from what task God has assigned you to perform in the church, as seen in 1 Corinthians 12:28 again, all Christians are equal, as Paul says in Galatians 3:26-29, where he even specifically argues that we are all equally related as sons of the same family. That makes the point. So here's the problem, guys. There is no distinction between actually being a brother of Jesus or just a Christian that was baptized into the faith. Now, taking this into consideration, this makes brothers of the Lord simply means Christians. And it's the simplest hypothesis, and it requires the fewest ad hoc assumptions. Thus, Occam's razor, right? And not one time in any of Paul's letters does he ever say or imply that this phrase means only biological brothers. So here Paul can only mean that all the other apostles, and even regular everyday Christians, and even Cephas himself, get the privilege of being fed by the congregations, and not have to do any work for it other than the church business that they're traveling for. And therefore, so should he. Because Paul's argument requires that the Corinthians would agree with him that he has the same rights as all three examples that he names. Therefore, Paul must mean by brothers of the Lord here is simply Christians. This finally makes the point of his argument clear. Because if even regular Christians were being given this privilege of being supported by the communities as they traveled on church business, then surely Paul should be as well, especially being an actual apostle. Now, likewise, by mentioning Cephas, or Peter, Paul clearly assumes that the Corinthians understood Cephas and himself to be equals, and deserving equal rights. Paul assumes this other places too, as seen in 1 Corinthians 1:12, as well as 3:22. So probably, Cephas was known to frequently travel with his wife, more so than other apostles Paul might have named. But in any case, what is required for Paul's argument is that Cephas and Paul were of equal rank, and therefore, whatever Cephas got, the Corinthians would be forced to agree that Paul should get it as well. The same sort of treatment, the red carpet. Feed me and I'm going to lay around. Otherwise, Paul could not use Cephas to make this argument, right? And the same entails that Paul cannot mean the biological brother or brothers of Jesus. For how could Paul expect the Corinthians to assume he was equal of even the Lord's own family? Unless the Corinthians would have agreed that their being his family gained them any special privileges. But then if that were the case, why would Paul single them out as an example? So Paul's argument here would make absolutely no sense to us if he was talking about the family of Jesus. But it makes perfect sense. It fits perfectly if he was talking about all Christians as a whole, and especially Christians of lower rank than himself. Against this conclusion, those arguing for historicity, they can only refer to evidence found outside the epistles. But that doesn't support them either. Because the Gospels, as we know, they do conceive of brothers for Jesus and even go as far as naming them, but then essentially declare that Jesus denounced them. The authors of the Gospels show no knowledge of these brothers even having been believers, much less apostles, even less privileged ones, except for Luke, who alone imagines them in the first congregation in the book of Acts, in Acts 1. But then shows no knowledge of them ever doing anything, much less being an apostle, and even less apostles of any kind of special status. For none of them appear anywhere in the Acts records of the church's public history, because they don't exist in the earliest history of the church. And it argues for the conclusion that they didn't exist altogether. It certainly doesn't argue for the opposite conclusion, right? That they were recognized privileged group of church leaders? No brothers of Jesus are found anywhere else in the New Testament either. Not even letters with their names on them claim such. And when it comes to evidence outside the New Testament, we can see just how ridiculous and unreliable it all is on this point. So Paul is surely just referring to non-apostolic Christians in 1 Corinthians 9:5, and not the family of Jesus. But what about this other one, this other reference in the same category, the brothers of the Lord? And the letter to the Galatians explains, "When it was the good pleasure of God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me, that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not confer with the flesh and blood right away, nor did I go to Jerusalem to those that were apostles before me. But I went to Arabia, and I again returned to Damascus. Then after 3 years, I went to Jerusalem to consult with Cephas, and I stayed with him for 15 days. But I did not see any of the other apostles, except for James, the brother of the Lord. And look, these things I'm writing to you. By God, I am not lying. Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia, and I was still unknown by face to the congregations of Judea that were in Christ." Galatians 1:15-22. So here once again we have another fictive kinship title, not a reference to James literally being the brother of Jesus, because we've already seen how Paul can use the phrase brothers of the Lord to mean Christians, since all Christians were in fact brothers of the Lord by cultic standards, right? And why would Paul have needed to be more specific if he meant brothers of the Lord by birth and not adoption? So here, more than likely, he's simply saying the same thing, that James in this case was simply a fellow brother in Christ. Indeed, Paul goes on to say that this James, unless he means a different one, was one of the three pillars of the highest repute in church, James and Cephas and John, as seen in Galatians 2:9. And even the gospel writers some 25, 30 years later also imagine these three guys as disciples and not family of Jesus at all. In fact, the Gospels uniformly report that this James and this John were actually brothers of each other and not Jesus. So maybe Paul have only known them that way too. Now certainly, in Galatians 1:19, Paul meant either James the pillar or another James altogether. And if he meant James the pillar, then he did not mean that he was literally the brother of Jesus, as that James appears to have been the brother of John and not of Jesus. So if we're going to maintain that Paul means that this James was the literal brother of Jesus, you have to conclude that Paul meant a different James in 1:19 than the ones that he mentions later on in Galatians 2:9 and again in 2:12. But that means whichever he is speaking of in 1:19 might not have been an apostle at all. And that may mean that Paul is using brothers of the Lord yet again to distinguish apostles from other Christians and not to identify the family of Jesus. The context of Paul's remark, once again, it's key here. It's critical. Because Paul is arguing that he receives all that he knows about the Christian mysteries through direct revelations from Jesus himself. Galatians 1, verses 6 to 12. That he didn't steal any of it by hearing other apostles teaching it and then passing himself off as an apostle who had heard it from the Lord himself. Therefore, it was crucial to argue that Paul had not even met any apostles until long after he had been preaching the gospel and initiating converts. That is why he insists not any Christian at all in Judea had ever met him. 1 verses 22 to 23, and that he only ever met one apostle, Cephas, or two if he means James was an apostle, and even That was only after 3 years of conducting his own ministry in Arabia as well as Damascus, as he says in chapter 1, 17 through 18. and then spending just 2 weeks in Jerusalem, then meeting no one else there for another 14 years. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now, whether Paul is actually lying about any of this or not, it's not relevant to what Paul wants the Galatians to think and what Paul actually means to say here. Because what he means to say is that no one in Judea had ever met him. And he swears this emphatically in Galatians 1:20. He admits that there were only two exceptions, Peter and James, and only for a brief while. And that was years after he saw the Lord personally in his visions. But in saying so, why didn't Paul just say, "Of them that were apostles before me, I met none except Peter and James"? So why does he go and construct this huge-ass convoluted sentence? You know, "I consulted with Peter, but another of the apostles I did not see, except for James." As L. Paul Trudinger puts it, this would certainly be an odd way for Paul to say that he only saw two apostles, Peter and James. To say that, a far simpler sentence would do. So why the complex sentence instead? Paul could perhaps mean that he consulted with Peter, but only saw James. He didn't discuss anything with James. But if that was his point, he would make sure to emphasize it, wouldn't he? Since that would be essential to his argument? Yet he doesn't. In fact, if he's saying that he saw none of the other apostles, that would entail that he was claiming he did not consult with any either. So it's just as likely, if not more so, that Paul means that he met only the apostle Peter and only one other Judean Christian, a certain brother James. Because by calling him brother of the Lord instead of an apostle, Paul is therefore distinguishing this James from any apostle of the same name. Just as we saw he used the brother of the Lord to distinguish regular Christians from apostles in 1 Corinthians 9:5. Now, this would also explain his rare use of the complete phrase in only two places. He otherwise uses the truncated brother of his fellow Christians. Yet, every time he specifically distinguishes apostles from non-apostolic Christians, he uses the full title for membership of the Christian congregation, brothers of the Lord, or sisters of the Lord likewise. This would be especially necessary to distinguish in such context brothers of the apostles, which would include kin, who were not believers, from brothers of the Lord, which also explains why he doesn't truncate the phrase precisely in those two places. So you might see how that would be important to Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 9:5, where it does seem that he takes similar care in specifying that only believing wives have the right in question, the right to travel, the right to be fed, and not have to work. Therefore, he must distinguish so as to exclude any unbelieving brothers for that same exact reason. Because if the James in Galatians 1:19 could likewise be mistaken for an unbelieving brother of Peter, especially by readers who did not know what brothers Peter may have had, Paul would need to be equally as specific there as well. And again, used a complete phrase. And if that's the case, then Paul would in fact be saying, "I didn't meet another of the apostles, unless you count brother James, who joined us but was not an apostle." Many biblical scholars have concluded the same thing, that Paul meant this James was not an apostle, whether or not he was an actual brother of Jesus. I am going to take a little citation here from Richard Carrier's On the Historicity of Jesus. Unfortunately, he does use Greek in here, and I'm going to pronounce it the best that I can. But the Greek here that Paul uses is actually pretty strange. Unless Paul actually meant, "other than the apostles, I saw only James," meaning quite specifically that this James was not an apostle. Now, ordinarily, to say that you saw no other apostles, you would write, in Greek, heteron ton apostolon oak, comparing 7:23:13:9, or aldina hereron ton apostolon, as Paul usually does, as 1 Corinthians 1:14, 2:8, and 9:15, or things that are similar to that. But here Paul instead chose the unusual, and for Paul this is actually unprecedented, an unprecedented construction of heteron ton apostolon. Without the use of audis, the word heteron plus the genitive in this fashion more often means other than rather than another of. You understand that? The way that Paul said it is other than rather than another of. So not an apostle. Paul would then be simply classifying the meeting with Cephas as a meeting with the apostles, as anticipated in 1:17, and then making sure that he named all the Christians that he met on that particular occasion, being Cephas and James, in anticipation of his claim that no one in Judea had ever seen him, as he claims in 1:22. So the later claim, it would be a lie if he had met any Christians, because he said he hasn't met any yet, even one who was not an apostle, during his visit to see Cephas in 1:18. So Paul has to name all the Christians that he met on that occasion. And lying or not, that number needed to be low for his argument to hold. Accordingly, Paul says there was only one other, Brother James. Now, the fact that Paul needs to say here that he met no Christians at all, and not just apostles in Galatians 1:18, in order to sustain his claim in 1:22 that no one in Judea had ever seen him or met him, means that we should expect Paul to have named any non-apostolic Christians that he met. Galatians 1:18 and 19. And lo and behold, that's exactly what he appears to do here, because he insists that no one else but a certain Brother James. So we should conclude, right, that Paul is doing the same thing here that he did in 1 Corinthians 9:5, using Brother of the Lord as an appellation for Christians, every time he wants to distinguish Christians generally from apostles, specifically. Otherwise, as we pointed out before, Paul would need to make clear that he meant a biological brother of the Lord, and not just this adoptive brother of the Lord like any other Christian. That he had to make such a distinction here all but entails he intended none. So we, you and me, should conclude the same. Now, one way to look at these two passages would be to ask ourselves, what would we think if we only had Paul's 7 authentic letters? Not the 8 additional 2nd and 3rd century forgeries in his name. If that was all the evidence that we had for Christianity, how would we conclude? Would we conclude that Paul was describing with the title, Brothers of the Lord, as a biological relationship or a cultic relationship? Because the evidence in all of Paul's letters alone strongly support the existence of the cultic relation, while providing no evidence for anyone having a biological relationship to that Lord. Therefore, you'll find biological interpretations is always based on literature outside of Paul's letters, including the forgeries, which we've surveyed many times and found wholly unreliable. So we have to conclude that there is simply no evidence in these two passages to support historicity. They're fully explicable without it, and do not make up for the gaping silence even in these passages, much less the vast and strange silence throughout the rest of Paul's letters, and all first century Christian literature, and none of which do brothers of Jesus ever get mentioned in any historical, credible way. So the question at hand is, how likely is it that Paul would use the phrase, brother of the Lord, on these two occasions? Galatians 1:19 and 1 Corinthians 9:5, and in their given context. And given our background knowledge that all Christians would be known as brothers of the Lord, can we conclude that we're talking about historicity? Or should we conclude that we're talking about mythicism? This celestial Jesus without historical family walking the earth. Because in historicity, we should expect far more and frequent discussions about the family of Jesus. Especially if, as these passages would entail, They were playing a major leadership role in the church at the time. We find the silence of Paul everywhere else, and his extreme ambiguity in these two passages, less likely on historicity. Now, I like to save the best for last, because what about those 500 eyewitnesses that saw Jesus raised from the dead? Now, if you're ever to ask a Christian, if you're on some sort of online debate or something, and you ask for evidence that someone witnessed Christ was resurrected from the dead, or prove it, well, they typically like to pull 1 Corinthians 15:6 out of their back pocket. And they usually come off like extremely confident and proud, as if they just had a gotcha moment. And they walk away like they just won the argument with their head in the air, shoulders back, and chest all pumped up. In fact, even in Lee Strobel's book and film, The Case for Christ, the 500 witnesses line seems to be the main theme carried throughout as that prize piece of evidence. This verse is from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, in which he says, according to our surviving manuscripts, that is, that after his death, Jesus appeared to more than 500 brethren at the same time. 1 Corinthians 15:6. But what Christians don't know, or keep concealed from the prize-winning argument, is the fact that we don't even have an account from any of those 500 as to what they saw or even claim to have seen. Christian congregations are simply duped into thinking that they saw what the Gospels say because that's what their pastor told them or what they read on that apologetic website cross-examined. But unfortunately, the Gospels don't even know anything about the appearance of 500 brethren. Not to mention, the author of Acts in 1:15-16 says that there were only 120 brethren altogether. And that's already certainly a legendary exaggeration. And Paul doesn't know anything about the absurd accounts found in the gospel narratives because they weren't invented yet, some 25, 30 years later. And trust me, guys, if Paul said 500 people saw Christ Jesus after his death, Mark would have been the first one to borrow it. Now, notably, Paul's text is probably corrupted, because we know that Christian literature has long been modified over centuries in order to make it fit within the current church's narrative that was trying to sell to the audience at the time. Now, more than likely, guys, what Paul originally must have said is all the brethren at the Pentecost, and not above 500 brethren. This is an easy mistake to make for a scribe, because the words for 500 and Pentecost are nearly identical in Greek, as are the words for all and above. Not to mention, Paul alludes to the resurrection of Jesus in terms that reference the Pentecost later on in that same chapter. Likewise, Luke used Paul's letters as a source for his book Acts and never once shows any knowledge of such a mass appearance, except for the very Pentecost event in Acts 2:1-4. There described an amorphous vision of seeing auroras and interpreting that as the visiting spirit of Jesus, which agrees with Acts' portrayal of Jesus' appearance to Paul as, again, an amorphous light. Look it up, Acts 9. Not what is portrayed in the Gospels as a walking, talking, shitting, farking, farting Jesus roaming the streets of Galilee. Either way, these 500 witnesses are not said by anyone. Not Paul, not even the Gospels some 30 years later. To have seen, much less touched or dined with, a flesh and blood Jesus. This is a crucial fact Christians either ignore or have not been told about. Nor are they told that this is the only appearance Paul says occurred to more than one person simultaneously. He uses the word for that only here. And that his description means a singular, brief experience. Not Jesus hanging around and dining with them for days on end, as the author we call Luke implausibly describes in Acts 1. And in contradiction to every other gospel, including, ironically, his own. So when we peel back the layers of myth and legend and get back to our earliest sources for Jesus, what we see is an amorphous, visionary, celestial space Jesus experience. So this is just another example of the creators of the website Cross-Examined, or your pastor, hiding the evidence from you, from Christian congregations. They're playing a shell game with you. They're leading you to the answer, the one that they want you to read. Because what's implied here is that we're talking about the gospel narratives in which there is never any appearance to 500 witnesses at all. And the appearance stories in the gospels contradict what Paul implies the witnesses most likely saw, which was an inner vision they took to be Jesus communicating to them from heaven. Not a guy walking up to them in a bodysuit that they got to touch and stick their fingers through his holes. If you ask the right question, can what Paul say be experienced in a mass religious ecstasy? Well, evidently, any honest psychologist will tell you yes. Christian apologetic websites like Cross-Examined keeps its audience in the dark and from ever hearing the strong arguments. Apologetics, once again, is the art of lying, deceiving, and concealing. Everybody, that's a wrap. And that concludes season 5. Before we roll into the new year, I got it done before Kris Kringlemas. Guys, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays and a Happy New Year. Know that I'm thinking about you, that I'm with you, and I hope the best for all of you and your families. Thank you for listening, and thank you so much from the bottom of my heart to yours for such a fantastic year of listening. Guys, we are actually on the path to hitting, well, we're going to be at 90,000 downloads coming up very quickly, but we will hit 100,000 downloads coming here in 2023, and I'm so jazzed, I'm so excited, and I'm so proud. I'm proud of you, I'm proud of me, I'm proud of the work that we did. And to think, I was actually getting ready to kind of hang up this show about a year ago. I thought it had kind of run its course. But it seems like I've got a lot more to talk about. And anyway, we've got some stuff that's pretty exciting coming up, and I'll start sharing with you on social media. But these last few episodes, we're talking about the evidence for historicity for Jesus and the letters, the 7 authentic letters of Paul. And that argument is a false Christian apologetic claim. As we just discussed in these last 3 episodes, it's highly unlikely. Again, it all pulls back to what Paul imagined between 45 and 55 of the Common Era was a space Jesus. Call it whatever you want. But what he was imagining was not a living, talking, walking, shitting, farting, skin, flesh man to talk to and poke your fingers through his holes. Anyway, guys, have a great holiday. Mwah! Love you lots. This, my friends, has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production.